This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
And we're back. It's Geek Squawks. My name is Jeff Sandro, together with Culture Pop's Matt Armitage, and we're back in the year 2017. I'm so happy.
Yeah, it's kind of okay for me because I don't need the machine to go backwards and forwards.
Yeah, me.
You know when you watch those TV shows and they say something like, "And an evil that's older than time itself." Well, you know, that's me.
Yeah, that's actually you. Now, you know, I'm glad that we're back in year 2017, but I'm not so sure about looking ahead in the future, because I came across an article, and this is around by, you know, many different sites. I'm picking the one from VentureBeat here.
Yeah, I'm going to let you explain this because I have a huge nonsense alert going off that just the second I saw this on New Scientist first.
Yes.
And, you know, I just, my brain just went through loads and loads of words that I can't repeat on air. But I'll let you go through it.
So the gist of it is that the writer of this article, you know, is saying that will you ever worship an AI god that will apparently emerge by the year 2042 and it will write its own Bible? And this is because reports have been surfaced, and this is why New Scientist and all have picked up. It's a controversy-plagued engineer who once worked at Uber, and he was the one that, you know, kind of stealed informations, and he was...
Yeah. So this is a project of his that they're saying he has to fall back on now that he's been sacked from
these
companies.
Anthony Lewandowski, he filed paperwork for a non-profit religious organization called The Way of the Future. And the mission is to develop and promote the realization of a godhead based on artificial intelligence, and through understanding and worship of the godhead, contribute to the betterment of society. Now, the thing is, for me, though, I mean, AI, you know, all its doom and gloom or its positivity, I don't see how we would ever worship AI as like a godlike creature or a figure or anything like that. I don't think we will ever worship, even if in the dystopian future or in the utopia of year 2022, I don't see AI as being something that, you know, I will open my, you know, wake up every day and I look at the AI and I go, you know, sprinkle water on him, or, you know, I just don't see it. I just don't see AI as being something to that degree, to that emotional being with me. Would it ever, though?
I think my big problem with this story is that, okay, my friends know my positions on religion. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go through them here
completely
on there because it's not really relevant to this. So whatever you believe, whether your God exists or doesn't exist, or you believe that somebody else's God doesn't exist, what we have here is somebody who is choosing to create a god. Now, that's the part that I don't really understand. If you get to a point in society where you've proven that either there is a god or there isn't a god, you know, categorically, why would you then decide to create one? If you prove, for example, that there is no god, why would somebody go to a computer and actually
and write something on
create
that,
one? You know, none of this makes any sense. I mean, there's no, if you're saying that you want a set of guiding principles, that's fine. If you're saying that you want AI to help with, you know, moral or ethical decisions by crunching through various prospects, again, that's fine. But you don't want to build an AI that you actually worship and serve. That would just be absolutely awful.
But it's scary to actually think there are people in great power and responsibility on their end that believes that this might actually work. Like, you know, we've got the person who runs a digital agency and an AI service believing in something like this could actually appear to be, you know, worthy of a worship. That could be an AI worthy of a worship. I'm just going like, no!
These are the same people who last year were worshipping Juicero.
Yes. Good comeback.
And I honestly think that, you know, it's only because of their position in the tech world that ideas like this get any kind of coverage or currency.
That is true.
If it was again, just that drunk bloke drooling into his into his pint at the end of the bar, you would dismiss it. Yeah. And that's really what this is. It's just, unfortunately, these people have the money and the influence to bring their drunken ramblings to life. I mean, Elon Musk is kind of the ultimate example of this. It's, you know, it's like every time he goes to the bathroom, any thought that he has while he's taking a shower suddenly becomes something that venture capitalists want to back. You know, if he if he said, oh, I think we need an artificial intelligence that tells me if I've scrubbed my back enough, you know, so somebody would actually build some kind of robot loofah the following week.
Yeah, yeah, that is true, though. Speaking of that Juicero thing, didn't someone just invented a tent recently and tried to rebrand it into something else?
Oh, that was, yeah, no, that was, I can't remember what it's called, but it's supposed to be like a timeout thing for stressed people in the workplace.
I remember seeing Vernon Chun, a good friend of ours, he posted on it on his Facebook and tagged you immediately because it's such a mad story.
Because you see, I'd seen that sort of 2 or 3 months ago pop up on, I think, Indiegogo.
Yes.
And I thought of doing it a story back then. But then I just thought, well, it's just a Wendy house. It's just like those little tent. I mean, we have one of those little tent things that we bought from IKEA for our cat.
These people have a responsibility that they're misusing it because...
Yeah. And the idea that some stressed out hipster needs to pitch a tent next to his desk to take a timeout. I mean, again, somebody asked me yesterday, do you think it's waterproof? And I said, well, it's probably for keeping tears in rather than rain out. Mm. So it doesn't really matter. It's awful, awful idea.
Yeah. Anyways, let's move on to New York City because apparently mice in New York City may be evolving to eat fast food like pizza.
Well, yeah, we all know that story from a couple of years ago of the pizza rat. That was a meme for a while. But scientists are actually looking into differences in species that diet has caused. So we know that diet has affected the human population. The population of Japan has grown in height. We know that average IQ levels have been increasing globally because of a richer diet that people have access to. So now scientists are looking at the ways diet can actually cause kind of evolutionary jumps in species. And they've rounded on this species of white-footed mice in New York. They're a native species. So they've taken a group of mice from the city, and they've taken a control group of mice from the countryside and compared their RNA to see if there are any changes in the genes and the cell structure. And surprisingly, they have actually found the first indications that there are. What they've discovered is that, again, it's too small a sample to be conclusive, but it indicates the way the research is going. What they've found is that the mice have started to adapt. Their cell structure has changed so that they can eat much richer, they can metabolize much richer foods. So their livers are enlarged, showing that they're consuming...
The bigger rats.
Well, I mean, they're not bigger. They have the conditioned fatty liver that human beings also get from a rich diet. So their bodies are starting to adapt to break down this additional fat. Mm-hmm. And it's causing them to go off in a different evolutionary direction to the animals out of the town. So it's only at the beginning stages at the moment, but it's a really nice example to see the way evolution can actually work in practice, because obviously mice go through very rapid generational cycles.
Yeah.
So we can start to see those changes quite quickly. Mm. And also it's not just the human food like pizza they might be eating. There is a kind of surfeit of food in the cities, whether it's discarded food from humans, but also in parks and these kind of other green spaces where there isn't so much other wildlife that would compete with them as it would in a kind of a rural setting.
I'm interested to know, you know, how our mice are in the year 2022, because, like, you know, it, and in the utopian world and the dystopian world as well.
Most of them are on little rafts.
Now, recently, three researchers have been awarded the Nobel Prize for something that we've mentioned before on the show a couple of times and we've tried to explain, but I'm not going to go into the explanation of this.
Oh, no, you are. Wait for a little pause as Jeff's brain reboots. Jeff is about to explain to you how gravitational waves work.
Yes, well, because three researchers, as I mentioned, have been awarded the Nobel Prize for their work in the detecting gravitational waves. These are ripples in space and time that travel throughout the universe. The recipients are Rainer Weiss, a physics professor from MIT, Kip Thorne, someone that we've actually mentioned on the show before a couple of times, a long time back before. It's very, very, very popular name. And also Barry Barish, who are both physics together with Kip Thorne. They are both physicists professor from Caltech. Now, the trio are key members of LIGO, or better known as the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. It's a scientific collaboration that made history when it announced last year the first ever detection of gravitational waves actually came through. And this is like over a century ago. Yes. Albert Einstein actually predicted that, you know, there is existence of, you know, these waves in his theory of general relativity. And he argued that every object in universe wraps the space and time around it. So when the object moves, it creates ripples in this space-time gravitational waves. A bit like it's like a ripple in a pond.
Yeah, no, it's exactly like a ripple in a pond, but it's something that we don't see.
Because we don't see
it,
yeah.
It happens in a plane or a dimension that isn't visual to us. So these machines actually help us to detect these ripples. The changes that are caused by the collisions between matter that radiate outwards across the universe.
Yeah, so LIGO, they boast two specialized detectors in Washington and also Louisiana designed to pick up these ripples, specifically the observatories to look for the gravitational waves stemming down from violent mergers of, you know, super dense faraway objects such as black holes or leftover stellar remnants known as neutron stars. So when these bodies come together, they spin around each other rapidly several times per second before joining to make one incredibly dense object. It's like a cosmic dance that creates a gargantuan ripples in the fabric of space time, which travels outward at the speed of light and eventually reaching Earth. So by the time it reached our planet, the gravitational waves have greatly been diminished, needing extremely sensitive instruments like LIGO detectors, which can pick them up. So in February 2016, LIGO announced that the two observatories had detected waves from black holes merging 1.3 billion light years away for the first time ever. So with that, though, they definitely, definitely deserve the Nobel Prize Award in Physics.
Yeah, there's a rule of thumb here that might make it easier for people, which is you can see LEGO with LIGO, but you can't see LIGO with LEGO.
If that makes any sense to you. We'll be right back with more. We have King of the Crowd up next, BFM 89.9. And we're back with Geek Squawks. My name is Jeff Santu, together with Culture Pop's Matt Armitage. And it's back, King of the Crowd.
Yes, this is a device. It's actually been around on the crowdfunding sites for quite a while now. And I think, Jeff, you actually spoke to the creator of this device a few weeks ago.
He's not the creator, but he's part of the team that created it. Okay. Yeah, and he was one of the person who had an instrumental impact on the growth of their successful Indiegogo campaign. Because the amount that they generated was just insane. They raised $1.13 million, and that itself, you know, it's 784% funded compared to, you know, that jump. So I spoke to him about how did they do it? How did they manage to get that, you know, $1.13 million in the Kickstarter Indiegogo campaign? So yeah,
okay. So that device is called Travis, and it's very simple. It is a universal translator. It can translate in real time 80 different languages. And one of the things about it is that it will help you to actually have conversations with people.
Yeah.
So when you look at things like Google Translate that we have access to at the moment, you can speak or you can, more often you type in your phrase and it comes out and you show it on the screen of your phone and somebody shows you something back in a language back, this is actually a natural language processing device. So you speak your phrase into the device, it translates it instantly, and the person you're speaking to can then reply in their language and it will translate for you. One of the reasons we haven't mentioned it before is because it seemed like such a fantastical device. Early prototypes were extremely huge. So it was odds on whether they were actually going to be able to miniaturize this enough to make it useful. Now, it does what it does over a 3G or a Wi-Fi chip, but you can also store languages offline. So you don't have to be connected all the time. The battery lasts around 12 hours. It's very small. It looks like a little, MiFi, right?
Yes, very tiny device.
Very small. It's very compact. You can put it in your pocket. But for people who travel a lot, especially to countries that, you know, maybe
don't speak your language.
That don't speak your language. Maybe, you know, there are countries where people don't speak English. If you're a native English speaker, there are also a lot of people who don't have access to, like you said, common languages.
Yeah.
And it's a really nice device. They have actually started shipping, which is why we're talking about it now. They've overcome the miniaturization issues. So really what you have is kind of an open source smartphone inside a little
device
that essentially just does one task, which is process language.
Which is, you know, interesting that we're bringing this up today, because just yesterday, you know, Google announced the Pixel Buds, which can translate automatically on the go. It could translate up to 20 languages on the go using Google Translator, and you all just have to listen.
This is kind of the future that we're going to, and a lot of this is based on the Douglas Adams idea of the babblefish Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So you'll see some apps and things that are called Babbel as well, which do exactly the same kind of thing. So really it's kind of a rush to market at this point. Google obviously has the advantage of Google, data and size, but I think what the company behind Travis has done with this device is actually really, really cool.
Yeah.
You can buy it today. They are shipping already. I think you can buy it for the price of $159 US plus shipping. Now, that is expected to go up to about $230 US when it gets to the full retail period. So I would get it now if you want one of these. Travis, the personal translator.
All right. Moving on to another story. Remember, we always talk about Hyperloop and, you know, Elon Musk's great idea, and he tweeted it out and everyone jumped into it and everyone decided to make something out of it. So Mexico, they want to build a Hyperloop that can cut a 6-hour trip down to 45 minutes. So it's basically a Hyperloop line traveling from Mexico City to Guadalajara in Mexico. It's currently in the works already because they have won a winning concept from a team working with the ever-popular Hyperloop One. So the futuristic transportation system would link Mexico's two powerhouse urban economies and cut down a 6-hour trip into 45 minutes. Good enough, we can now translate, you know, different languages live on the go. We could now just travel to different countries or different states where, you know, probably would be a completely different, you know, language if we could just do a 6-hour trip down to 45 minutes. I don't mind doing a longer trip than that, you know, you
could get down to Singapore in half an hour if it was here.
So this Hyperloop thing, though, it's not just a gimmick anymore now. It's a real thing. Do you believe it's going to happen? Like, it will actually work? It will transport humans in this tube that, you know, floats using that, you know, that levitation magnet thing?
I think the idea of Mexico doing this is very, very different to the idea of it being done in the US. When you look at high-speed rail lines in any developed economy, what they tend to do is actually shift resources away from rural branch lines. So when we say, oh, we're connecting two regional powerhouse cities, What it actually does is tends to take money away from the rural communities around them. So it will take money away from the branch lines that feed those rural communities into those major urban hubs.
Yeah.
So you're actually kind of bypassing them. So when you have a country like Mexico, which is still to a large extent developing, and you put this kind of distortion into place, I think it can have a very destabilizing effect, because it's going to be very, very expensive to do. And you already have huge disparities between the cities and rural living in countries like Mexico. Mm. And this kind of technology often tends to accentuate those differences rather than allowing people to kind of bring those levels together. So I don't necessarily see it as a good thing for Mexico at this point. I think the money is probably better spent doing kind of regional development kind of things. But again, if it's funded by, you know, private businesses who have that money to to waste, go ahead, see what happens.
So apparently, if everything goes according to plan, the Max Loop, it's what they're calling it, the Max Loop will be serving 68 million people by the year 2020, which isn't very long. Recently, Hyperloop, they raised $85 million in funding to bring this Max Loop plans into reality. So,
but the thing is, I mean, that they always say things like serving 68 million people, and it's the same with high-speed rail lines. But the cost of producing it means to travel on it is so expensive. Yeah. You don't serve 68 million people. You serve 600 people.
Yeah.
Because only those 600 people can afford to use the service. Mm,
the 100s and the ungraded.
I don't know what your problem is with the 100s, ungraded scum.
So let's move on to something a bit more positive, Matt. Energy from evaporating water could rival wind and solar.
Well, I'm not,
evaporating water.
I'm not sure if this is so positive. I mean, this is the this is the idea of another source of renewable energy that we haven't really been looking at. So when you look at solar energy, one of the reasons we know that solar energy is so powerful is that water evaporates.
Yeah.
The heat of the sun causes water to evaporate. So now what scientists are thinking, a guy called, I think it's a guy, Özgür Sahin at Columbia University, what they're looking at is an idea of harnessing this evaporating water and using it to generate electricity. Now, it's a really nice theory, and the team is coming up with some very small prototypes. Mm-hmm. And again, even the prototypes, the machines for doing this kind of generation are very, very different. They're almost biological in nature. What they're looking at is these kind of threads that are coated with bacteria. And because of the changes in humidity caused by the evaporation, these kind of threads will flex. And so they think of them like a muscle. So when you move your arm, for example, your muscles flex or they contract, you know, and this would be exactly the same. So you'd have this kind of almost like tissue going backwards and forwards, like a strong piece of elastic, pulling it and snapping it back. And that would create the force that generates the electricity. So that's what they're thinking of doing. There is a lot of potential here. I mean, you could, I think they said something like...
But harnessing is definitely a big problem.
Not just the harnessing. One of the things is that there is so much water that evaporates that it could actually meet the needs of entire states, the energy needs of entire states. However, there is an issue with that, because the water evaporates for a reason. So we can't actually stop all the water from evaporating because then it won't rain.
Yeah.
So we do actually need that water to go up into the sky at some point. What other competing scientists are saying is that it probably isn't realistic to think about. The idea of putting these kind of machines at a commercial level is probably not feasible for the near future. And again, large-scale use of this could have quite a distorting effect on our environment and on the climate. One of the uses that they do see it perhaps being used is not for it to be used, say, over rivers or over the oceans or over lakes and things, but actually to be used over things like fields which are irrigated, because that water is often wasted because it's not naturally occurring in that source. It's pumped there. It wouldn't normally be evaporating from there. So if they do get this technology online, that would be one way of reusing that water that goes to, to irrigate the fields. And also it has the other benefit of changing the climate and the humidity for the things that are growing as well. You can control the amount of sunlight that comes through to the plants using this kind of technology as well. So that is one potential application. But for the time being, it seems that, you know, wind and solar and fossil fuels still dominating, are still going to be, go-to technologies.
Who knows in the future, right? Evaporating water will power vehicles and stuff.
Well, yeah, you know, all of us will just be sitting at home boiling our kettle all the time. You'll be boiling your kettle to power the air conditioning, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. Hey, I'm going to make the room hot to make it cold.
Let's move on to Geek Tunes. Matt, what do you have for this week?
I have, for the first time, a song that I'm not actually even sure that I like. This is a band that I saw from a post that a friend of mine made, Faraz Khan. So he put this on Facebook yesterday. This is a band called Pale Waves. And it's kind of weird. The vocals sound like they belong on some kind of pop hit, whereas the band sound like they're some kind of 90s indie band. So, like I said, I can't quite get my head around it. So I thought I'd put it out there for everyone else and see what everyone else thinks. This is Pale Waves with Television Romance.
BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.